Okay, so we are the non-models group, hello. And today we're going to talk about tissue dynamics underlying an insect appendage outgrowth. And as you probably remember from last week, appendages in insects come from imaginal discs. And here, as for reference, it's the late imaginal disc of Drosophila. The different colors indicate different domains of gene expression that are important for the specification of this appendage. Later on, this is in the larval stage. Later on, when you go to pupal stage, the leg actually extends, but you continue to have different domains of gene expression. Eventually, this culminates in the formation of different segments, highly specified that have, as you can see, different sizes and shapes according to the proximal distal axis. Because we are working with non-models, actually we decided to approach this problem to try to understand how is the leg outgrowth happening in Tribolium and in gorillas, which are both insects somewhat related to Drosophila, and in particular to the adult leg. Studies have been made comparing the expression patterns of different genes and showing that indeed somewhat these regions of expression are maintained throughout a number of genes that are important for the appendage formation. In particular for distal less, the only thing that is truly known across these different insects is that if you don't express it, you won't have the appendage formation. But despite all this conservation of gene expression, no one has really looked into the cell dynamics of these non-models. So that's actually our aim, was to try to understand what are the cellular behaviors leading to this appendage outgrowth morphogenesis. And initially, so I'm going to give you like a general overview of the tissue so that then my colleagues can explain you better what we did. So looking at Tribolium, these are initial stages of appendages outgrowth, and you can see several outgrowths in looking from the top of this animal. And actually, even from early stages on, we can already detect that there is a separation between ectoderm and mesoderm. Later on, actually, these appendages start to elongate, and in 3D, of course. And eventually, 2 days later from this, you can already detect differential segments in this place. So this is quite interesting because development is happening quite fast. You have all these different cell behaviors that you can approach, like cell division and cell elongation, and so on. But then we also decided to look at gorillas, so cricket. And here, because the cells are much bigger, we actually got better cellular resolution. And immediately we could detect again the two layers of ectoderm and mesoderm, like we saw in Tribolium. So we started to think that maybe we could actually correlate the two things and try to do parallel approaches to try to get some conclusions out of it. Anyway, what we could immediately see from gorillas, at least, is that indeed the cell divisions were highly dynamic and seemed stereotypic somehow. So, with this in mind, we set an ambitious aim into trying to establish this analysis in 3D datasets. And indeed, we actually tried to apply, and we're going to show you analysis from PIV correlated with cell density, cell divisions, and then conformal mapping. First, with the idea of trying to understand this in 3D, automated versus manual quantification.
While you saw this really nice pipeline we've like basically lined up here, our original goal was actually to do 3D cell tracking. Since we're here, we saw like amazing spin movies and confocal movies and people tracking cells through like whole tissues, and we were like, oh, we want to do this too. And there are like tons of people presenting different software packages, and we're like, let's do Mammoth, let's do Elastic, let's do all of them. In the end, we pretty much did none of them. So it turns out it's not as easy as we thought. However, I did a little success. I managed to got one of Lars Hufnagel's little test data sets tracked, so success. But then we realized that he just makes way nicer images than we do. So that was basically we basically, as a backup plan, went back to PIV. And so this is a masked Tribolium data set, so you can see where's the head right now. So basically, you see four legs right here. And I actually don't know where the head is right now.
It was actually
here's the head. What we try to do is do different cell packings, like the density of cells drive tissue speed, and also do we see different tissue speeds? Draw basically an axis from right here, in terms of this direction, do we see different tissue speeds or velocities? So I did a bit of 3D PIV analysis, and so we didn't really have nuclei staining, we had darky staining, but since we had a nice elastic mask for, oh no, we didn't have darky, sorry, yeah, we had
histone.
Somehow we stained nuclei. And I basically, the basic assumption underlying of this is that nuclei volume is proportional to cellular volume, hence our masks are giving us somewhat a readout on the cellular density in particular regions in the embryo. And so I counted the, I computed the nuclei density and looked how fast is the tissue moving. And as always with y-axis for me, don't look at units, we only want to know relatively if density is a factor, but this is, don't mind about the units. And turns out at low densities, things are moving way faster than high densities. Well, I thought, well, this makes sense. If there's a lot of space, I can move faster. If there's just a bunch of people around me, I can move, can't move that really fast. And that was the case for overall the whole tissue, but also for all my four legs. And then,
sorry, is this 2D PIV or 3D PIV?
This is a 3D PIV. If you would give me another day, I can split it up for you in coordinates and tell you. This is right now just literally any speed.
And the velocity vectors, do they usually just go away in this direction, or do they have random?
So they're of course slightly noisy. I didn't have the time to prepare you a nice clever plot, but most of them point this way. But turns out our data is also a little bit noisy, so it's a little bit better. Some are kind of off.
Can you explain a little bit? So then there's a fair bit of density variation, right? You know, factors 3 or 4. Where in that picture do I find low density regions?
Where it is, where there's nothing, pretty much. There's no cell here.
Okay. So another question. So if I look right there in the middle, whatever part of the animal that is, that looks like pretty high density. Appendages themselves are also high density when you look in the right projection. So that middle region is not part of the measurement?
It is part of the measurement if I look at overall tissue. Overall tissue is literally the whole image.
Okay, hold on, I still don't understand it. Legs.
Yeah. Right,
so I'm looking now at the blue trace, so that's leg one.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this big difference in density.
Mm-hmm.
So can you please explain where that density variation is in leg one?
I would say between those black region right here and the really
But this is some sort of projection. I'm still trying to understand whether the big difference is in one case you're looking at the surface and another case you're looking
I mean, this is right now just one out of 40 set stacks. I literally looked at the whole volume and computed the... Basically, I computed the number... So I have a mask that basically stains nuclei, and basically I count the number of ones in the mask and divide it by my averaging box. And it's, of course, the same averaging box I used for the velocity field.
I think Boris is asking, why are the magenta and green boxes, they look like the limbs are empty, and the blue and yellow ones look like they're full. Is that right?
Oh, there?
No, just if you look at the boxes in the micrograph. Is that what you're asking?
That's precisely.
That's
a projection, right?
Is the mesoderm and ectoderm? Because the green is magenta.
That's just a slice.
Yeah, it's one slice.
So this is one slice. Yeah, this is not a projection. This is just one slice. Okay.
So this is sort of saying that there is an epithelial shell, and that's presumably a high density region, and then there is some 3D density inside that shell, different cell types, who knows, and that's the stuff at lower density.
Yeah, this is what Rita introduced.
Okay,
But isn't there an issue, which is PIV depends, I mean, right, the reason PIV works is that you need variation in pixel intensities, and the low density regions are exactly where you're doing a bad job with PIV measurements because you have less pixel variation. And so really, this is a very tricky, I mean, you're making large errors in the low density regime. Fact.
So... So I was actually last night I was trying to fiddle around with basically making adjusting the finding the optimal parameters where I basically get rid of this. And I was not really able to, probably because it was 6 years down and 2 o'clock. And this is the truth, I'm sorry. What I also tried to do is I tried to filter out everything with low density. I didn't put the plot on because I wasn't really sure if this is a proper thing to do. Because I had, so by the thing that I got was I got some elastic train masks. So I thought that whatever I see is not noise. I actually filtered out the noise. So I kept it in. However, I probably should have also taken it out, but from what I got, I assumed that I got some really just sweet ass masks and kept it in.
So if you go back to the lab one again, can you explain the sigmoidal shape that I see?
Oh, this?
Yeah, why there is this sharp transition of the velocity
I asked myself the same too. It could be that this is my sweet spot for cutting off densities from noise, and then I would actually just see a really homogeneous velocity field, and then that would density would not influence at all my or only a small. Raise my velocity field.
It's not obvious why it's noise. Right?
No, it's not obvious.
They seem to be moving fast, so if there is, and if you're doing PIV, so it's not like you're tracking and the errors in tracking.
The error bars don't scale, right? It'd be constant throughout.
It could be the direct transition from these two tissue types, the ectoderm and the mesoderm, and then it's a real transition between them.
If I may say something, it's often in tracking, a lot of the PIV programs, they just fill in holes with whatever the arrows are on the border, so it means you would get large areas with just constant arrows, which might contribute to this in the holes.
So that basically is a question like choosing the right box size of my PV.
It fills holes with basically arrows which extrapolate from this area around it. So I was wondering if some of this might be happening.
I'm not completely sure. So to be honest, this is the first time in my life that I had PID. So I'm, even though I had a really good introduction from, I think, my doctor, the lecturer, I'm completely new to it. So this is literally the first time that I'm doing PID. And I'm still trying to really figure out, I guess it's with any analysis, like getting a good grasp on how to fine tune parameters and how to basically interpret this. So this is my. The original plan was to like literally look at those legs, fit kind of like a parabola through the outgrowth axis, and then like kind of convert this into radial coordinates and see how like things are moving and whatnot. Due to time constraints, there was a no-go. So literally, I just made like a line through here and basically looked at the velocities in this direction, basically. And turns out, like, it looks a little bit like it's like. So those boxes here, by the way, don't completely represent those curves. I drew them again, roughly the same size, but not completely. It looks like, at least to me, there is no. They all show like kind of like an increase and then a drop and then an increase again as distance continues. So this could be that somehow we're like going this way, then there's like lower velocity here and then higher velocity as we like at the part where we actually grow out. So this would be my preliminary guess.
Okay, so after that, we also wanted to look at how the sublimations are in the development of the appendages, and we saw by looking at the movies that we can recognize very easily by eye where the cell divisions are, and also the daughters of that cell that is divided. So we were wondering if we could write a program that did that for us, and then compare it to manual tracking. And yeah, so.
Sorry.
Yep.
What is in the between the, like, yes, what is in the center? Is there a space?
Okay, so this is it, stuck. So we have, from a confocal, we have, I think, around 20 is stuck for each time point. And here we are seeing a movie for one Z stuck. So, and here you can see the mesoderm and the ectoderm. So,
I guess my question is, the mesoderm is surrounding a bag of fluid or something?
Oh, this, you mean?
Yeah. When you play the movie, there was like void.
For dividing. Oh, so these are dividing cells.
No. If you play your previous movie, this movie, there's like here, there's a void in between.
Oh, yeah, but if you move in another set stack, that fills up.
Sure, but is that fluid?
Oh, fluid.
This is a single section.
It's mesoderm, so yes, you have space between cells, but it's
I mean, the mesoderm that populates the limbs comes from these mesodermal structures called celomic pouches, which are called that way because they are true celomes. They are mesodermally lined cavities that are filled with fluid. They proliferate and fill in the segments that contain appendages. And and they fill the epidermal space with cells, but because they come from something that is hollow but it has fluid in it, for some time before that becomes completely packed with mesoderm, there is a small hollow space in the middle that it's filled with celomic fluid.
So that is exactly what we're coming to.
Okay, so one thing, it seems that all the cells that divide, especially around that region, they always rearrange the location before the division.
Yeah, Taro mentioned that they look as if they move to the outside, divide, and then come back.
Is that expected, or what kind of mechanism controls, or...
Yeah, I would like to address that, but yeah, we only looked at the orientation of the cell divisions because, yeah, it was very good.
But for some types of stratified epithelia, that is very common. That nuclei will move to a certain plane, divide, and then move back.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they look for a place where they have enough space to. Okay, so in order to automatize that cell division tracking, we thought about what we do when we want to actually do it manually. So if you look at the set stack, when you want to look for a metaphase cell, you look for a very eccentric shape, which is very bright, and which area is not that big as the other one. And if you want to then look for the daughter cells, you actually look at where your mother cell was and see whether you can find bright spots, which are very eccentric as well, and that the area is not big. And after discussions with Nick, and a thousand lines of code written, we managed to actually track some of the divisions. Not all of them, but the code works pretty well. So these are images that the program gives us. We segment the in 3D. The data that we obtain from the confocal. So then we can classify each of the nuclei in 3D. And then we look for bright eccentric small area shape spots in our image, and we classify them as dividing cells. And then we can also look at the orientation of that dividing cell. What else do we look for? Yeah, major axis, minor axis. And then if we move a time point afterwards, we look for bright spots that are close to it, and then we label them as daughters of the previous cells. And we do it in the different set stacks. So we...
Talking.
And then the question was, okay, so actually another thing that we wanted to address was that, okay, if we have this division, we can say that the division is going to be in the perpendicular axis to the ellipse that we fit, but actually you can see that the daughter cells move, so it was necessary to look at the daughters to see the division axis.
Sorry, quick question. It seems like when you look at the movie, all the divisions, right, they're all up in the plane where you are looking at the movie.
Yeah, so I look at three Z stacks before the one where I found the mother.
Yeah.
And three, so like in a neighborhood of that.
Yeah, because it can happen in the movie. can look like they are all in the same plane.
Yeah, but it's not always the case. But I mean, it's already striking that a lot of them, it's not something, so it means that you already have some kind of direction, right, where you are remaining on this plane, or more or less on this plane. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Good question. So then we thought we obtained the data, and then we wanted to visualize what we found. And a way that we thought about it was a heat map. So each spot here is a division, and it's represented in 3D. So these proximal distal axes, anterior posterior, etc. And then we colored them with respect to the angle. The angle with respect to the anterior posterior axis, and we expected to find regions which are colored the same.
Did you account for the curvature of the?
Yeah, good question. So we wanted to address that, as Alex said, by fitting a parabola to the axis, but that was a bit difficult. We didn't have time, so we just did it with respect to the anterior posterior. But then we saw that they're pretty random. So we don't know whether it's because we have an error in the code or because it actually like that. We wanted to do manual tracking as well to compare, and that's what Irving is going to tell us.
Yeah, so I will talk about the results we had. We hope at the beginning we had at least three different Grilus movies. We wanted to apply this to the three different movies, but unfortunately we did it for one movie. So we present what we did the result. So just to introduce, so it's another movie, so it's not the same one, but To just the manual way of looking at the orientation, you see here several cells that divide there, and so they're in the same plane. That's cool. Because when you do it manually, it's impossible to look at the one that can be oriented according to the curvature. But I think with the code we should be able to see the one that are the same. As far as there are two. So we just basically draw a line saying this is the axis of the elongation of the leg, and draw some lines. So here the green represents the orientation of the division. And so this red here represents just I didn't take this one into account, I just counted the green ones, so the ones that are separated, because we can rotate between data phase and so if I plot, I am about 30 division here, and if we plot it as a gross plot, you can see that they are mainly, so it was for the 21st time point, because I didn't want to do it for the 180 time point we had, so I put it for 20, and you see that it looks like they are quite correctly oriented, so mostly parallel to the proximus axis.
How many divisions is that?
About 30. So it's why I took big beam because and also you don't have a lot here, but it's probably due to the way that I made the measurements.
But do we have to worry about sort of systematic bias? So what would happen if a cell was dividing with the axis pointing into the screen?
By hand, I would not measure it. Right. Because I would not.
For example, so therefore, the big hole that we see at the file or two, those are the guys that, or gals, that are dividing in the transverse direction.
It could, I mean, we could fill this part here with division that would be like that on the plane. And if already by hand, you see a bias, that there is, this bias is visible. Here, for example, it's a problem because.
It's not that they're dividing along proximal-distal axis here. So the perpendicular axis that shows up at pi over 2 here would be division out of plane, right? So that would be a division not within a layer, but right, that's sort of whatever, apical basal.
So you mean that by end I miss all this one and I miss.
But the ones that would be dividing along, if you like, the azimuthal direction, you don't see by hand in the slices.
Yeah.
But you will see them, right? Because you will see itself that enter. They enter metaphase, and then you only see one cell and you see the other disappearing inside. So it would be a mitosis in which you only get one daughter cell. So
but are we counting them?
No. But do you see them?
We it's what we say. They are mostly in the same plane. So probably for this tissue, in this example here, it's not too much an issue because I don't think I miss so many. Cells that I see in metaphase and that I would not be able to locate after, but that could be a point. But that's a good point because we wanted to say also the differences that the advantages of doing it automatically, and we are all convinced that it would be better to do it properly, but we wanted to see the differences, and that's an important difference. By end, you cannot look at things in 3D. I mean, it's very difficult.
But if just directly on that, at the surface of the leg, you would count.
Yeah, at the surface of the leg, you.
And this was a lot of tissue that you were seeing there. And then you directly have the axis going in the other direction.
At the surface of the leg, you could imagine cells that go into the tissue, and you would miss them too, and
they
would
be
90 degrees or something.
But it would be shifted in the opposite direction to the proximate distal axis. And so you would have got those three.
Just use the different Z's.
Yep.
So now this the comparison between the different measures that we made. So that's the manual for that's the image before. Yeah, that's the movie that which I now worked to make the cut. If I will come for the 20 first time point, we observe something that looks approximately like the one before. We also have about 30 divisions, so it's not a lot, so we wouldn't definitely conclude about that with that. And if we make the automated analysis for the 20 first time points on exactly the same set, we observe similar behavior and with maybe more like that obviously more like perpendicular than in this annual counting. So that could be due to cells that I miss by n and that are perpendicular. But so it looks like there are two populations in this for the 21st time point. But if we look on the for here, it's 100 time points. In this case, it's really much more random. So we really have
sorry, quick question. Are you measuring the angle to the plane or to the axis, because and can change also the metric, right? Because when you do it manually, you did with the plane, right? Because you are always drawing the axis, and then you change the plane, and then you draw again the axis. So you are measuring against the plane. How are you doing it for the automatic?
We are still thinking. Maybe you want to
against the plane.
Yeah.
Okay.
You find the daughter cells that can be in different.
Yeah.
But then you find the centroids in 2D in each set stack.
Yeah.
And then in 2D, you measure the angle to that. It's like if you project them in Z stack to the same one, and then you put the two Z.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so you don't measure, I mean, we can think about the measure the angle.
I'm just checking if it's the same metric that you're using.
Yeah, so it's the same. Yeah.
All right.
So yeah, I would have loved to, of course, to have something that looks like what we expected. So because by eyes it looks like they were oriented, but of course it's not the case. The problem is that I can't even conclude that there is no bias in the orientation because of the time that we have to do the analysis. There are too many parameters that we don't control. But you are, the first thing is to make a mass piezoelastic. You have to make a mass that is as good as possible. And here in this particular case, the mask has been done, we train elastic for only the first time point. And so then we apply this mask for the only time point. And the good way to do it would be to take sample, to take different time points all along the course of the time lapse. So there are a lot of ways to improve this and to verify first if the software gives the same result as what we would have by hand. Not what we would have by hand, because it can be biased too, but what is it if it's represents the truth, the reality of the. And also, one other thing that can bring noise in this is that when I do it by hand, I just selected. So if we can see it on this previous images, by hand, I just measure this for this leg. But in the image, in the movie, we can have here some stuff, and generally the movie, improves the movie are not cropped like that. So. We can have picked a lot of divisions that come from everywhere else and that could have other reference. So that's a lot of small issues.
I guess the biggest issue is sort of defining the axis, right?
Yeah.
You really have to define the local axis on the surface. And that's,
First we wanted to find the line around the leg and compared to the tangent of that line, but it was very difficult to parameterize that parametry, because also it changed in the time, and it also changed in the data, and that was it.
We wanted them to fit an ellipse here and measure compared to this ellipse, but in this case, for example, the ellipse would be in another orientation, and in terms of mathematics, or what I understood, it's more tricky.
Okay, so I'd like to kind of continuing this discussion of the mechanics of how these appendages grow, and specifically with respect to the role of cell divisions and the orientation of cell divisions in this growth process. I'd like to play you a quick video that I think is pretty interesting. So this is a maximum intensity projection of this same stack that we've been looking at. So this is a gorilla slide. And before I get to the next slide, we were calling this leg pirate the whole week. And in one of my slides, I call it pirate. I don't want it to be all of a sudden out of nowhere. It doesn't make any sense. But so I'm going to play this for you.
Tell them why it's pirate.
Pirates only. So when I play this, if I can play this with my swing hands, automatic, great. So I think what you notice, which is shoddily quantified on this graph here, is that the internal angles of this triangle, this maximum intensity projection, remain relatively constant, except for some jitter towards the initial frames. It's cut off here after 11 time points. After 11 time points, the cell that we've been tracking at vertex A begins to divide, and the triangle falls apart. But I think this is interesting that the angles appear to be constant, even though if you notice in the middle, this triangle is containing a division of angles. So we've heard a lot, almost ad nauseum, about how tissues can flow, right? How cells can flow on these 2D tissue surfaces. So we can have these processes like global flow, where cells don't exchange neighbors. We can have intercalations, where cells exchange neighbors. But these types of processes can't affect surface deformation. Whereas other processes, so cell death, or the removal of a cell from the surface by migration towards the interior, dilation, shrinking, and cell division, cause the surface to change. It would be interesting, I think, to attempt to quantify the role of each of these deformation processes in the actual growth process of the limb. So the contributions of cell growth, contributions of division. And additionally, it would be interesting to determine the how important the non-deformation processes are during this sequence of time. So for instance, whether or not cells have large global flow velocities and are moving very drastically from their initial time positions without changing their shape, dividing, or leaving the surface. Whether or not the cells remain relatively close to their initial time points and instead only undergo these processes that lead towards surface deformation. Additionally, how these deformation processes might contribute to the stresses on the surface as the limb grows. So relating to the idea that these cells might remain close to their initial locations, if that's true, if these non-deformation processes are relatively unimportant during this period of time, then it's plausible that looking at deformations of area, so choosing some area of interest on your original surface and tracking that area as it grows and changes and the surface deforms, could lead towards some type of predictor for cell lineages. And this is especially interesting because we believe that for the most part, distances and intercell distances and sizes of limbs are relatively conserved across different embryos. So if you could do this, it would be somewhat of an interesting method for relating these complicated structures at the end of growth to different areas at the beginning. And so this here is a map of the growth process, the type of mapping I'm about to talk about. So if you heard me say angles remain constant in the beginning, first thing you think is conformal mapping. So for people who haven't heard that before, it's not a terribly complicated thing to think about. Basically, all it means is that if I were to draw a set of coordinates on this 2D surface, and not just for 2D, but for the purposes of the talk right now, let's just imagine that a 2D surface embedded in 3D. If I were to draw a set of coordinates on that surface, that the angles between my coordinate lines remain constant as I change them, as I go to a different coordinate system. So the map is between one coordinate system and another. So this is a nice illustration of it. So this is a rum line or a loxodrome. Imagine you're flying from LAX to Heathrow, and your compass is always pointing due north. A Mercator projection is a conformal map because on this rum line, the angles between your trajectory and the meridian's line of longitude are always conserved. And if you're interested, this is an area element in a Mercator map. Probably you aren't interested. Okay, so conformal mapping. Right. So it's not just limited to simple surfaces like a sphere. Conformal maps can be made for any surface you can imagine, complex surfaces like this one, like a human face. And again, just to reiterate, it's not a scary thing to be inhibited by, it's just a lookup table. It's you have a coordinate on this 2D surface embedded in 3 space, you have a lookup table that then maps it to a plane, an actual plane in 2D, right? So I can say map I'm not exactly sure where that goes to, but let's pretend that this section on the space maps to this triangle here. And so the question then is how, the question that you can also do this obviously on computers, right? And so the idea is then from instead of doing a continuous space thing, we now have to make a conformal map on a from a discretized mesh describing our surface to now a discretized mesh in the plane. So what is the defining aspect of a conformal map? How do we know that it's conformal? So there's this object called the metric tensor that describes our map. And physicists and mathematicians, please forgive me this somewhat misleading cartoon, but I think if you haven't been introduced to the metric tensor in this context, it's a reasonable way to think about what it is. So imagine my surface had, so these are the coordinate lines of my surface. And if my surface is totally flat, I can think about this as being springs all at their rest line, at some minimum energy. And as I deform the surface, and these coordinate lines change, I have to expend energy to do this. They're no longer at their rest line. So, and again, so physicists and mathematicians, I mean, this is weird because now I'm talking about coordinate lines changing, and the metric is an intrinsically defined thing, but it's reasonable here. So this should also, if you're familiar with string tensor, you can, looking at the form of the metric, is mathematically identical to a Porsche to the Cauchy deformation tensor. So if you're looking at a Lagrangian type strain in a surface, we can relate the metric to being a measure of strain and distortion. So now we have a measure of distortion. The metric also defines the angles on the surface. So we can make sure that our mapping is conformal. And so what can this also tell us physically? What can we extrapolate from this? So here, we can imagine, and we can see that if this is a measure of energy, so just this relative strain from a metric at time t as the surface evolves to a reference tensor, reference metric, so the metric describing the original surface at the initial time point, that small conformal changes would minimize this energy. So if this deformation is a conformal process, you can imagine that the underlying mechanisms act so as to, at each time point, minimize the expenditure of energy necessary for deformation. And additionally, if we have these small conformal changes, small deformations, immediately make you think of linear elasticity, and if you have linear elastic and you know the strain, you get stress for free, which is nice. And so this down here is kind of a form that we'd be interested for the analytic part of it. So this is basically the definition of a conformal mapping, just the idea that as time changes, the current metric is related to the original metric just by scaling with a position-dependent growth factor. So I hope that did it. So now the question is, how do we do this, and what kind of tools can we use? Of course, you can use Insane. I think this was especially exciting for Sebastian. we get to finally use it after a year and a half of development. We finally get to use Insane to do some science. And it's finally returned. So most of the things that this mapping needed to do were already implemented in Insane. And it's really great for Sebastian for his help. So here we have a map of the surface that we've been looking at for this whole presentation. And this is, so here's the conformal map that we made. Let me play it for you. Isn't that gorgeous? No, seriously, it's cool. Basically, the idea is that we have the process to observe these maps. You know, it's not just because we have the map doesn't necessarily show that the actual process is a conformal growth, but we now have the maps. We can start looking at things and making testable predictions. Right? So this is starting.
So this is the pirate actually mapped into onto the original surface.
Onto the original. original surface.
Well, I'm sorry, this is 3D, this is 2D?
This is 2D. So we extracted a surface, and I'm saying, we did the whole process, point cloud, make a mesh, fit a surface, and then we map the surface using a spectral parameterization algorithm that you're aware of. And I'll talk a little bit of the caveats of that algorithm in my final slide. But this is each, as a changing, is a time point, and this is a conformal map of the surface at each time point.
So the immediate bit of information is so the fact that the nuclei appear so different in size.
There's significant distortion.
Contains information, right? So that's sort of the local dilation factor that relates it to an original.
So you get a you get these local dilation factors. You can directly relate the distortion to. Where you can find the distortion directly using the metric and relate this to the strain and relate this to the stress as well. And also, interestingly, I mean, you can look here at the orientation of these divided nuclei or interesting landmarks that you have in the plane. One, it's computationally less expensive than looking at it in 3D. And also, Jackie, you had your question about whether or not these axes were aligned on the surface. So in 3D, it's very difficult to try and find something. But using this conformal mapping procedure, I can tell you all sorts of tandy vectors. I can give you any axis you want on the surface. So if I want to define some axis and I know where it's located, I can now actually relate the orientation of these nuclei to some prescribed curved axis on the surface.
So it is a 3D structure. So where is this 2D map?
Where is the 2D map? So the 2D map lives in the plane.
No, I understand that, but the surface in 3D, and you have a 3D structure, so where you are on your surface in 3D, where do you take it?
Is
it the ectodermal set?
Yeah, it's the
okay. I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question. Yes, this is the ectodermal. And this is a video of the same data, but with some tracking. Using Elastic's pixel classification automated tracking workflow, which is really, really useful. It's mostly pretty good. There would still be work to be done if you wanted to extract series A from this, but the idea is that it's possible to track cells in this 2D map. Methods exist to possibly do this. And if you track cells in the map, you can track area deformations. You can track distortions. I'll talk about that. So now, future directions, where can this go? So really what we managed to do in this 2D process was just kind of a proof of concept. There was really not too many results that we found, but the idea is there's lots of things that we can now do. And so from the interesting biological, this stuff is kind of interesting maybe for physicists and for people interested in the application or implementation of computer algorithms, but this interesting biological stuff, you could do something like to extract that growth factor I showed and use it from some set of time points and use that to try and predict growth at later time points or growth in a different embryo in which we believe that similar growth patterns are conserved. Cross-correlation of the prediction with the result, with the actual measured results, would give an indication of the validity of the assumption that growth is actually a conformal process. And if growth is a conformal process, and we believe that, then we have these methods for determining distortion and strain the orientation of certain landmarks along curved non-trivial axes. Furthermore, if we do some type of cell tracking and compare if we manage to make a good cell tracking algorithm, we can determine the importance of these non-deformation cell reorientations, so flows and intercalations, And if we determine that those events are not extremely important, we can then begin to use this prediction of area distortion as a predictor of cell lineage. And then back now to what Elena was talking about, if all of this stuff is true, we can use it to go to conformal, and we can use it to predict area distortion. We can also try to figure out the underlying connection between distortions of the surface and these deformation events. So whether or not the orientation of cell division is the primary driver or a primary driver of surface distortion. And this wouldn't necessarily just be limited to cricket limbs. I know Taro was excited about possibly doing something similar for chicken limbs, right? So that's basically it. Thank you to Matt and Cassandra and Sebastian and Nick and Boris and Taro.
Is it true? It looks like a lot of the mitosis were synchronous. Sorry, you know.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
When you looked at if mitosis are more synchronized than you would expect, as opposed to being random. I mean, it looked like there's always a bunch of cells that divide about the same time. So I'm wondering if that's true or not.
We had this feeling at first, but honestly, we didn't quantify it. So. That was even one of the possibilities for the differences in oriented subdivisions, that with time we will have differences in synchronization.
It's not collision.